Good evening, I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. Like a canary in a coal mine, a big canary, do California's rolling blackouts signal trouble ahead for us as our own deregulation of utilities proceeds ahead here in Massachusetts? Or are the Golden State's problems a self-inflicted wound that need not be duplicated in New England or anywhere else for that matter? And if New England can avoid blackouts and brownouts, at what price? To help answer these questions and many others, we welcome tonight three men whose work and areas of study are business, energy and the environment, and regulatory law. Their expertise should help us find our way through the thicket of competing claims and finger-pointing that seems to accompany any discussion of the power crisis. Our guests are Dr. Cutler J. Cleveland, Director of the Boston University Center for Energy and Environmental Studies. Professor?
Hi, Ted. Thanks for having me.
Keith Hilton, professor of law at the Boston University School of Law, a recognized expert on law and economics, as well as antitrust action. Keith.
Hi, Ted. Thanks for inviting me.
And from the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, Executive Vice President Robert Ruddock, who until recently served as Senior Vice President for Energy and the Environment. Bob.
Hi, Ted. How are you today?
Just fine. Let's begin by naming and then describing the various players in any electricity deregulation situation. Off the top of my head, it seems there are utility companies, legislatures, state regulators, consumer groups, environmental activists, federal regulators, and power generators, which may or may not be utility companies. So help me out. Who are the chief actors? What are their roles? And how do they all fit together?
Well, to the laundry list, Ted, I'd add there are also state regulators and consumers could be viewed as being broken down into residential consumers, commercial consumers, and then industrial consumers. And then I would add that there is a way to look at utilities now with deregulation, which really means that there are companies that have the wires to your home, the traditional utilities that we know. The generators, as you pointed out, are a separate group now. And there is also a group of companies called the transmission owners, and they operate the high bulk transmission, high tension wires. Mm-hmm. And there's also another group called energy marketers who are out there trying to hustle new energy services.
Bob Ruddock, that sounds like it's extremely confusing. And maybe that's one of the problems California's having. Too many players? Well, what role do they play? How do they fit together?
Well, a lot of this, in fact, was always there. It just was never apparent to the ultimate consumer because it was all bundled in back of the, the Boston Edison or the Mass Electric or the Western Mass Electric utility company. But in fact, they own transmissions, they own generation, they had energy conservation services, they had some renewable programs and so forth. So all of that was always there. Deregulation or restructuring has made all of this more transparent and more apparent.
Okay. Well, I wonder, is there some way you could simplify the list? If you were to say, for example, that we could divide the market up into companies that transmit power, companies that generate power, call them generators and transmitters or mm-hmm. distributors. Is there mm-hmm. some way to simplify this list and put them in broader categories mm-hmm. so that people out there who, like me, came to this subject not knowing much about the power industry would have a sense of two or three sure. main players?
That's Professor Keith Hilton from the School of Law. Right. Is there a way of bundling the players?
There are, if you will, manufacturers of the power, the power plants. Mm-hmm. There are the companies that transmit the power, either high tension or retail, into your home. There are companies that will come in and do energy conservation services, and they're a real player because it turns out that one of the themes that runs through electric deregulation is that the consumer is going to have more choices, and that includes not only the choice to buy power, but also the choice not to buy it.
Okay, but before we go too far in this direction, let me ask you, Professor Cleveland, where is the energy? Where does it come from?
Well, in the case of New England, we're in a unique situation relative to the rest of the country, and certainly California, that we rely a lot more on oil to heat our homes and generate some of our electricity compared to other countries. But across the country as a whole, about half of our electricity is generated by coal, and the rest of it comes from natural gas, hydropower, and nuclear power.
Are you familiar with where the sources of power are for California?
I don't. I think that I do. I don't know the exact breakdown.
Right.
I think it's quite a wide range of sources. They do import a fair amount of power from the Northwest, which is a center of hydropower in the United States. And California also leads the nation in so-called green power, that is, power generated from renewable sources like wind turbines, photovoltaic cells, and other alternative sources such as fuel cells.
Some data I have suggests almost exactly what you just said, is about 50% of the power in California comes from natural gas and hydro, and the hydro is mostly imported. What is interesting, again, buttressing what the professor just said, is that the rest of the 50% is evenly divided from nuclear, coal, and renewable energy, which means that there's a much higher contribution of renewable power in California than there is here. Considerably less oil and less coal than there is here, as a matter of fact.
All right. So we're mostly oil, you said?
Well, not mostly oil, but we are unique. I don't know what the exact fraction is, but relative to other parts of the country, we do import. We do use a fair amount of oil to generate electricity in New England. But following up on the fuel mix used to generate electricity, that's a central part of the deregulation issue, because one of the important set of actors, again, getting back to this list of actors who are playing out this game, are what I would call, to get to a broad grouping, of institutional actors. And you mentioned environmental groups, but I would generalize that into what are called NGOs, non-governmental organizations, who in this era of deregulation, where the decision-making has become more decentralized and open, they have become major players. And so you have environmental groups who tend to have a particular political axe to grind. They're interested in the promotion of green power, perhaps, or they're interested in removing subsidies for conventional fuels. They may be interested in global warming. They all tend to have a specific focus. You have consumer groups as another NGO who are interested in the prices that consumers pay and looking out for the welfare of the consumer. And you also have a lot of groups who are pro-fossil fuel combustion or pro-nuclear power, who all have their particular axes to grind and needs to promote. And so all these forces, of these institutional forces, come out in the fray of deregulation.
Okay, let's hold that for just a moment. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about deregulation, what it was intended to do, what it really did, both in California and in Massachusetts. I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. We're holding a roundtable discussion on where New England stands compared to California with respect to electrical power now and in the future. And our guests from the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, Executive Vice President Robert Ruddick, from the Boston University School of Law, a professor who is not only a professor of law but holds a doctorate in economics, Keith Hilton, and from the Boston University Center for Energy and Environmental Studies, Professor Cutler J. Cleveland. I'm Ted O'Brien. This is BU's World of Ideas. Welcome back to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Now that we have, I think, some sense of every finger that's going to be into this pie, when the utilities were regulated, how did that work?
Well, as I mentioned a moment ago, in fact, all of those players were there. The professor, I think, is very correct in identifying the fact that a lot of them were commentators before. Now they're players. In fact, there is a thing called the New England Power Pool, a very complex thing to explain, but it is essentially the governing board for how energy is dispatched and how energy is charged among all the utilities. And that board used to be totally made up of utility, is now broken into five parts. One of those parts is our consumers, rather, which includes actually organizations such as AIM, as well as environmental groups with renewable portfolios and things like that, and those types of agendas. And that is a real participation in the rulemaking, with quotes around that word, rulemaking, that we've never seen before.
But my understanding was that in the past, power was a regulated monopoly.
That's correct.
That's right. Yes.
All right. So how did it operate then? The rate-setting commission made a decision on what consumer would pay?
The State Department of Public Utilities made decisions on what the rates were for the consumer, whether it's mm-hmm. residential, commercial, or industrial. In back of that were agreements among the power companies as to which generator would be used at a certain time to have least cost generation of power. And agreements over the price to charge for moving power over the high transmission lines. All of that was embedded in that process, but again, not transparent to John Q. and Mary Q. Poe.
Okay, and the utilities were a separate category, even on the New York Stock Exchange, right? People looked on them as something separate because they were regulated monopolies and allowed a margin of profit, but it was not a gross margin of profit. They were steady and they were secure, isn't that?
That's correct. In theory, they were allowed to charge a price such that they would earn a rate of return on their capital investment, a rate of profit that was in the same ballpark as companies in the private sector operate in a free market, assuming that the regulators were smart enough to know what their rate was, which is a whole other kettle of fish.
Well, right. Was this a uniform thing across the country under regulation, that each state had its DPU, its rate-setting commission, tried to gather information? Bob, maybe you could answer that.
Yes. Okay. That's essentially – the model was essentially replicated in every state and really grew out of 70 years or so of how electricity was used in the United States.
Okay.
And occasionally, from time to time, the government itself, of course, would step in. And I'm thinking the rural electrification programs mm-hmm. during the 30s and early 40s. And then there's actually one of the other players actually is government itself and public power, which is another issue entirely.
Ted, I'd like to add something to that.
Keith, go right ahead.
One of the longstanding issues in this area that economists were complaining about is that consumers, regulators really didn't have their hands on the information that the power company officials knew. And so that was a regulatory game that worked, that at least was set up so that it could work to the advantage of the insiders, the ones who ran the companies and had their hands on the information. Now, whether that's the way it really worked, that's a different issue. But certainly it was vulnerable to that critique.
There might be hidden profit in there somewhere.
True, consumers
that's correct.
Know.
Yeah, this image of the smoke-filled room where, mm-hmm. you know, these mm-hmm. bureaucrats and technocrats would sit and decide how much electricity would cost. And the idea behind one of the ideas behind deregulation, as Keith indicated, one of the advantages in theory is to open this process up and let the market
make it more transparent,
make the information more available. But one of the problems that we've seen in California in particular, getting back to that case, is that, in fact, that process through this particular type of deregulation wasn't allowed to operate. I believe the Attorney General in California is investigating whether there was collusion between the groups involved in the deregulation, the utilities, and the big consumers out there. Because some consumer groups charge there was a deal between the big three utilities who have a keen interest in hanging on to their residential consumers base mm-hmm. in deregulation mm-hmm. and large industrial and commercial consumers who want to hang on to cheap power. Mm-hmm. And there was a feeling that there was a bit of a smoke-filled room deal wrangling going on that shouldn't have happened.
Was there any federal authority overseeing these kinds of relationships?
Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is the federal agency that regulates the movement of power among states and actually licenses, for example, hydroelectric plants. And so it plays a role. And in fact, as deregulation has moved forward, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC as it's known, is playing a larger and larger role in how the regional markets are structured, who governs them, who makes up the rules, how the voting, and I told you before, the need pool mm-hmm. was, in a sense, democratized. That actually came as a result of a FERC order. And in fact, there was a recent order by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to request from each of the regions in the United States plans as to how they would further improve the regional dispatch of power, including expanding the regions. And there is actually a proposal pending in Washington to expand the Northeast region to include not only New England, but also the New York State Power Organization, and also what they call PMJ, which is Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Maryland, and also includes.
So you're getting larger and larger groups, but right. One-sixth of our economy is in California, right. And that's where all the trouble is. And if you'd continue, Professor Cutler, to describe the impact of deregulation there and how you felt that it was working.
Clearly, on the economic side, in the short run, it's failed miserably to deliver what they promised. I think in the 1996 legislation that started the whole thing rolling, they promised a 20% reduction in residential rates by April 2002. And, of course, prices have gone just the other way, at least in the short run. On the environmental front, it's had some contrasting impacts. It's ironic that in San Diego, one of the cities hardest hit, and in other places, by brownouts and so on, they're now screaming for energy conservation and energy efficiency programs. But under the in the deregulated environment, due to the way the regulations were structured, there was actually a huge disinvestment by utilities in energy efficiency and conservation. In fact, since between 1994 and 1998, the amount of money spent by California utilities on energy conservation dropped by a half.
Why?
Well, the way it was prior to deregulation, utilities were prohibited from buying power on the open market on an as-needed basis. So there was an incentive to meet peak demand. It was cheaper to invest in conserving power than there was in building new power plants. Through a complex series of regulations that I'm not going to go into, that incentive has been turned on its head. And now the incentive is to sell the power as fast as they can to generate revenue and buy it on at today's prices, with the cost being passed immediately on to consumers. So,
although one could argue as that price has gone up in California, unfortunately for those consumers, there is now an incentive for the consumers themselves to take control of their own efficiency and load management, their own demand.
But so, even there, Bob, but it's capped in California, and well, it's the neighboring states that are getting the 25% and 30% high.
They're actually, what I'd like to do is contrast what actually happened in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts, for our deregulation law, there was embedded in it a continuation of conservation programs and a new fee that we're all paying, which is a renewable trust fund fee that will be used to pilot renewables in Massachusetts in the state to actually drive down, you know, pilot projects to drive down the cost of power for these projects. So that certainly was never abandoned in Massachusetts. And the other thing that happened in Massachusetts that didn't happen in California is that while there is a slightly increasing cost for power so that it was controlled over a seven-year period, there also was an escape hatch to allow for extraordinary costs to be passed on. And that's what's in Massachusetts. The costs are going up, as we know, even though there was a promise to reduce the charges. In fact, those prices are going up as a result primarily, 99%, I believe, of the gas increases in gas and, to a lesser degree, the increases in oil. The smart people that I talk to tell me that they still believe that we are better off with the deregulation we have, that if these costs were imposed on our older costs, they'd be higher in an absolute way than we're paying now.
Yeah. Ted, can I say something about the move, the general move from regulation to deregulation?
I was just about to ask you that.
Begin with the old model, the one that you described a few minutes ago, Ted. We had a regulated monopoly, often described in the economics textbooks as a vertically integrated monopoly in the sense that it both controlled power generation and power distribution or transmission. Interestingly, in the subject that I teach, antitrust, you had a bunch of antitrust cases in the 1980s, late 1970s, that tried to break that link between generation and distribution to try to force local utilities to wheel power from other generators to open their lines up. So, in other words, under the old system, one of the complaints that consumers had was that they were forced to, in a sense, take the power that was given by the owner of the transmission lines. And that's the general theory behind deregulation, is sort of open to break that link, that monopoly, that link between transmission lines and power generation. And now we have a world in which ownership of the transmission lines no longer controls who provides the power, what's the ultimate source of the power. And this allows, in theory, it allows for cheaper electricity by allowing consumers to get their hands on the cheapest generators and allow those cheapest generators to provide power through the local transmission lines.
And compete against each other.
Compete against each other.
The natural gas people would compete with the oil people, who'd compete with the hydro people.
Right. Exactly.
Right. But is that happening in California?
Well,
it is to an extent in terms of spur innovation. We've spent a lot of time talking about the expected effects of deregulation on our consumer prices. But another one of the incentives is that these old regulated monopolies had little incentive to innovate new technologies, particularly in the area I'm interested in, green power. There was no incentive to go out and develop, or little incentive to go out and develop these new power sources. In a deregulated environment, you'd open the doors to the competition, and these things would have, a chance to compete. Well, in California, we have, in fact, seen quite a bit of that. Since consumers actually had the ability to choose among power companies in 1998 in California, about 2.5% of all the customers' base have switched. Over 90% of those people have switched to green power. So it shows that, at least in the sense of opening up choices amongst power sources and spurring innovation, it is working to some extent in California.
One of the other things, just to pick up on what Cutler said a second ago, is that there, in fact, was in New England because of embedded financing costs for some of the old.
This is Bob Ruddick talking from
Nuclear Power
Industries of Massachusetts.
Right, the nuclear power plants. The utilities in the early 90s didn't have an incentive to build new plants. They'd patch up the old ones. And so we actually stopped having new plants developed by the utilities. There were some merchant plants being built. And since deregulation went in, there's been a massive increase in the amount of generation, all fired by gas, which is, on a relative basis, cleaner than oil and coal.
Keith Hilton, you had something.
Given that the California deregulatory scheme imposes fairly hard caps on prices at the retail level, what incentive is it? What is it that's causing consumers to switch to green power? I mean, is there a difference in rates? Maybe you could tell me what's the key? What's making them?
I think it's the fact that Californians want green power.
Okay.
Yeah. And they value that's an important aspect of the commodity being sold, that a kilowatt-hour of electricity from a wind turbine is valued differently than a kilowatt-hour of electricity from a nuclear power plant to some people.
Okay. There's actually some public opinion surveys that were done at the beginning of the California experience as well as here, which suggested that customers would, in fact, pay more for green power.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the questions is that if you have hard caps at the retail level, to what extent are those choices reflecting choices they would make in a real market? I mean, if they're being protected from the costs of green power, then maybe they're choosing green power in situations where they might not be willing to pay for green power if they had to pay the.
Well, let's go into that a little bit. There is no cap in New England. There is this extraordinary circumstances escape hatch, I think you said.
Well, there is in Massachusetts. There, in fact, is what we call a standard offer, which is that all customers, after on the day deregulation was signed, it was seamless to them. They didn't even know what happened because the rate was, in fact, fixed. It is a fixed rate. What is different between Massachusetts and California is that our fixed rate here, the legislature and the Department of Telecommunications and Energy acknowledged that there may be extraordinary circumstances, and one of them being a truly radical increase in fuel costs. And in fact, there was a band created so that if the price went above this band, then the Department of Telecommunications and Energy could open up those rates and look on a petition. And that's what they have just recently done.
They just did that based on natural gas.
That's
they're holding hearings all over the state.
Well, that's natural gas for consumers who use gas in their industrial settings or in their homes for domestic hot water.
So our situation is a little better, but it seems to me that one thing we've learned, the deregulation is regulated deregulation.
Mm-hmm. Well, the argument that I've always, or the terms that I've heard used, is that it's something of a misnomer to call this deregulation. Uh-huh. It should be called restructuring with consumer choice, and that is probably a better handle.
Okay.
Because part of this system will always be regulated. In fact, the wires component of your bill, the price that, say, my utility charges for to deliver the power to my, that is continued to be fixed by the Department of Telecommunications and Energy. That's the new name for our Department of Public Utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll be on the same basis of cost to supply the service plus a fair rate of return of profit.
That's Robert Ruddick. He is Executive Vice President of Associated Industries of Massachusetts. And he is joined this evening by Professor Cutler Cleveland of the Boston University Center for Energy and Environmental Studies and Professor of Law Keith Hilton, who is also an economist with a doctorate in that field from the Boston University School of Law. This is Boston University's World of Ideas, where we've been talking about the energy crisis, whether California can happen here. We've seen that although California and Massachusetts operated very similarly while regulated, the two states got their energy from a different mix of sources. And also, and more particularly, they deregulated differently. The question now is, what's happening? How is deregulation actually working? And how are the energy generators interacting with the deregulated utilities? Let me ask you, if the generators are competing or colluding? You laughed, Bob.
Well, the reason is because, as Professor Cleveland indicated earlier, there are allegations in California of collusion. I guess between the utilities plus with large customers. I was not aware of the large customer angle. And there have been in New England a couple of instances of particularly high peaks, very, very huge run-ups on a – actually, in one case, it was for a four-hour period. And there are issues then about whether there was gaming in the marketplace. As a generator saw this happening, would they simply withhold their power until the number kept getting up higher and higher? That's actually under review by the independent system operator, which is the dispatch system for New England, which is separate from the utilities and everybody else. It sits out in Holyoke, Massachusetts, and it is supposed to be the disinterested party who would look at something like that. And my understanding is they are looking at that.
I think we may never know the answer to that question. Clearly, I think the regulation has created a new kind of incentive, a perverse one, for collusion to occur. These spikes in prices and the drop in power output from utilities look pretty suspicious. Whether or not they'll ever find a smoking gun, I'm not sure. Power output from an individual plant varies over the cycle of a day and a week for a lot of very legitimate operating and technical reasons. Mm-hmm. And so whether a particular reduction that happens to coincide with a period of overall shortage was because someone was doing it intentionally or not is a fairly difficult thing to sort out.
Let me say something about the collusion hypothesis. We're, again, in the classic position of the consumer is that we just don't know what's going on back there. I tend offhand to be fairly skeptical of the collusion hypothesis because it strikes me that there's an enormous incentive to make a killing by undercutting the price that someone else is charging if they are really engaged in a collusive scheme. Now, we know if there's a collusive scheme that involves an explicit agreement, that is, they're calling each other on the phone and they're saying, hey, you know, we're going to cut back on supply. Well, that's illegal. That's a Sherman Act violation, mm-hmm. and the officials and the companies would face the risk of jail terms. Presumably, they know that and they wouldn't take that risk. Then the question is whether it's implicit, that is, a non-explicit kind of understanding. We know what we'll do, and if that's the theory, and it's maybe a more plausible theory, it still runs into the problem that there's always this enormous incentive to undercut and to beat out the people who were holding back.
Professor Hilton, let me follow that up. What you're the economist here. What is the free market intended to do? What is deregulation intended to do? We've seen a lot of it. We've seen it with the airlines. We've seen it now with utilities. The idea is to free the market. I look at the airlines, and now they're bundling back together. They're all merging back together so that we might wind up with three big airline companies. What is deregulation intended to do?
In general, it's fair to say it's intended to introduce more competition, introduce more entry into an area. And the theory that competition and entry will regulate prices, keep prices down. In other words, rather than having some regulatory board examine the evidence and check your prices to make sure they're justified by the costs, the theory is that competition would play this role.
How does this play out in your experience? How does it play out in the actuality?
Well, you gave the case of airline deregulation. I think in general, the evidence is that airline deregulation has worked.
What's the measure of success there?
The measure of success, I think if you look at most studies that look at the price per passenger mile, and even the studies of safety, even the studies of accident rates show improvement. In general, a strong trend toward improvement in all of these areas since deregulation. And that's about the best measure I think you could use.
In my view, competition among the power suppliers has within it the embedded idea that they will undercut each other to gain the most amount of sales that they can. One of the issues, though, which is in California and arguably, I suppose, could be raised in Massachusetts and New England, is what happens if there aren't enough, if there isn't enough supply. Forget about how many suppliers there are, and whether or not the constraints on supply then tend to signal to the players that we don't have to, the number that we want to sell our power at, we could hold out for a little while longer. Now, that is another opportunity, I suppose, for the market to signal that if you're smart enough as to what's happening, then you can hold back or do perfectly reasonable things. If you don't want to sell something, you don't have to sell it. And therefore, the price will rise up. The question for me is, what is society's response and the consumer's response to that? And it seems to me that's like threefold. First one is have systems that make sure that there is more than enough supply. And in fact, part of the electric deregulation restructuring law in Massachusetts was to provide a more streamlined siting process for new power plants. And that has been successful. In New England, we're going to see about 7,300 megawatts of power in the next some of it's already in place in the next 18 months. That's one thing. The other thing, though, is how can a customer, and obviously it's a little more difficult for the individual customer, but how could groups of customers participate by withholding their demand and moderate costs as a result of them deciding not to buy the power? And then the third piece is what role does efficiency programs and renewable programs play in actually participating in the marketplace to, in effect, undercut the supply? And I was at a conference day before yesterday where Commissioner O'Connor from our State Department of Energy Resources observed that he understands that about 150 megawatts of power was actually withdrawn from the market as a result of efficiency programs, which in fact tended to reduce the peak on a couple of days last summer. The net result, of course, was that when that peak got reduced, the power plant people said, I got to sell my power, otherwise I'm going to have a $100 million building sitting here with no dough coming in. So all three, more supply, which in this case also means cleaner supply, relatively cleaner supply, efficiency programs that can deliver real reductions and what they also call load management programs, they play a role in the marketplace, giving the customer more power than they have now, which is, again, what I think deregulation
is. And then individual groups, you said, that would be the third piece, groups getting together.
Yes. I mean, they're at the beginning of this, there were notions that groups would come together and be aggregators of buying aggregators. So all four of us, we get together and say, you know, you use 10, you use 10, you use 10, I use 10. Let's go out and see what 40 can buy on the marketplace and create what's called bilateral contracts. You don't want to know those things. But contracts with generators. That hasn't been as vibrant as certainly I and AIM would like. But it is a notion out there. The other notion is not only do we get together to buy power, but we could get together to avoid the purchase of power. And in fact, a couple of our members have recently installed cogeneration facilities, mm-hmm. and they are leaving the supply of electricity from the traditional utility companies entirely.
Mm-hmm. One very important point that needs to be considered in any deregulatory or regulatory scheme is what sort of incentives you create for the generation of additional power. And one of the problems in California, of course, is you have this hard cap at the retail level. So I could easily imagine any person in the business saying, well, why would I build a new plant? Why would I want to generate extra power when I can't sell it at the market price to consumers?
Okay, but I must tell you that I'm still confused as to why the price rose in California. I guess I'm not confused there. It was lack of supply. The natural gas was drawn down as a result of a very hot summer in Texas and the Southwest last year.
There's also a reduction in hydropower coming in from the northern states.
They didn't get quite as much rainfall as
they had a drier
expected.
Summer. That's right.
That's right. So that's understandable. But the surrounding states are getting all the power they need at hikes of 25% to 34%. So in a sense, the brownouts and the rolling blackouts in California are caused by the economy, the economics of the thing.
It's not. I wouldn't say it's just the – I mean, the regulatory scheme is, I think, very important here. We have a regulatory scheme that sets low prices at the retail level, and therefore consumers have no incentive to cut back. Consumers have no incentive to constrain their uses. People thinking in the long term don't have any incentive to – develop energy-efficient methods of using their power. And that creates excess demand. One of the reasons that you have these large rates is you have a lot of people demanding power in California, and then you have other things on the cost side, environmental regulations, all sorts of things driving up the cost. You put those two together, and there that explains those very large...
But my understanding is that the generators, looking at the cap, sold their power elsewhere.
Well, let's assume that that's true. Fair assumption, I think. It is, as Professor Hilton was suggesting, that there were caps here and there were no caps over there. Mm-hmm. Where is the place that you sell your power to? In Massachusetts, our Department of Telecommunications and Energy and the statute that the legislature passed did have this safety valve that I mentioned a moment ago, so that our prices are going up very high. Historically as high as earlier problems that we had in the 70s and late 80s. But we are not incurring what's called deferrals. What happened in California is those utility companies, because they needed the power, would go out and buy the power at the market rate, only be able to sell it at a constrained retail rate, and they were financing out over time hundreds and then billions of dollars. Our organization actually testified before the DTE 2 months ago that first the cost of fuel should be verified, then they should be those costs should be passed on immediately to avoid deferrals, and then third, there also should be examinations to whether or not there were other opportunities to mitigate the cost to consumers.
One of those things about the deferrals that I read concerning California was that parent companies had been scooping up, according to some people, large amounts of money from the companies and letting the deferrals build in the subsidiary company. So that in a sense, that was another way that the scheme was not working the way that it was supposed to work. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that or not. Mm-hmm. We'll just move on.
Well, but what Massachusetts, it seems to me, ought to learn from what's happened in California, and that may be one of the lessons that we learn, not just Massachusetts, frankly, all of the states that have already deregulated.
Is it possible to have a totally free market in a commodity that everybody needs all the time?
No, I don't think. I think this speaks to the issue that Keith raised and which you originally raised, which is what can we expect deregulation in a freer, more competitive market to actually deliver to society? And I think Keith nicely articulated the principles which, in theory, free markets deliver. And apparently in some cases, like the airline industry, they have. But I think something that environmental scientists are and economists are interested in is can we really expect the – to what extent can we expect a free market in electricity regulation to reduce some of the environmental impacts of electricity generation, which are huge? And I think we have to have a sober view of what the market really can do. All the things that it's supposed to do in terms of spurring innovation, lower prices, are based on a lot of assumptions which – rarely exist in the real world. A couple of the problems with the environment, with the power markets and energy markets in general in the U.S. is that they have a lot of externalities associated with the price. That is, there are costs of generating a kilowatt hour of electricity from coal or nuclear, which have impacts on the environment, acid rain, nuclear waste disposal, and so on, which aren't reflected in the price. And they're also heavily subsidized. Every power generation, including renewable energy, is subsidized. So we don't really know, with the combination of these subsidies and externalities, what the true costs of these power of the different types of power are. Some of them are hard to quantify, and so the market is not sending the best signals it could if we knew what all those costs were.
Can I take a different slant on that? I'm not going to disagree with the bottom line. I might disagree with a few of the assumptions and the premises in Cutler's argument. I don't know how helpful it is to use terms like regulation and deregulation here, because one thing we're seeing is sure, you really can't avoid regulation altogether. The question is, what kind of regulatory scheme are you going to set up? The idea behind what's called, quote unquote, deregulation in California is to move toward a market. And I think is a sound principle. And many of the environmental problems that Cutler is referring to, you could deal with, you could incorporate into a market-based approach. I mean, for example, the cost to local residences of having a power generator near them, or the environmental cost. These are things that I think you can measure. You can get measures of these things, and you can impose or internalize these costs to the companies in the form of taxes or in the form of compensation requirements. And once you do that, you can open up a system that allows them to pass those prices on to consumers. And under that world, I think the economists would say, the economists and the environmentalists could get along pretty well, and they could say, gee, you know, we could protect the environment and have a working market-based regulatory scheme. So one of the problems with California is just the wrong approach toward
regulation. I think you're absolutely right. And I think a lot of environmental costs can be quantified, and the market-based instruments are being used, for example, in sulfur dioxide emissions to reduce emissions. But then you're up – let's assume that we could quantify all these costs, including the big costs like the contribution to global warming, which become very difficult to measure. Then you bump up against political realities. So now you'll find that these costs are very, very large and a significant fraction of the price. So now we have to rely on politicians to try and pass these costs on to consumers. And then you're in a realm where it becomes very politically unpalatable, because no one's going to run on the platform of raising power rates, raising gasoline rates. I mean, Americans think somewhere in the Bill of Rights that it says you have the right to a dollar of gasoline forever.
I can understand. Well, the issue, I suppose, is, though, those are costs that existed prior to deregulation, and it didn't happen then, and it's apparently, from your point, it's not happening now, although I agree with Professor Hilton.
I think it has a greater potential to happen now with a freer market than it did in
the
past.
Well, there were a number of very prominent environmental organizations in Massachusetts that were big supporters of electric deregulation, because they believed, in fact, that the restructuring would lead to a replacement of the older power plants with gas, more efficient generation of kilowatt hours.
At this point, given the fact that 1/6 of the economy is tied up in California, is there a role for the federal government? You've already mentioned, Bob Ruddick, that there are regional consortia now coming together to try and deal with this. Is there a role for the federal government that's a little bit more than just saying, well, we'll take a look at it?
I'm going to give the common sense, intuitive answer right now, not based on regulatory law. for the most part, California's problems seem to be of their own doing, seem to be the result of their own flawed, quote-unquote, deregulatory scheme. Now, when the federal government takes an interest, it's presumably because the rest of us, the people in Massachusetts, the people in states around California, are impacted by this, and therefore there's a reason for the federal government to take a hand in this. Certainly this problem, to the extent that the environmental problems, for example, are broader than simply California, then that suggests a possible federal role. To the extent that the power outages in California are going to have impacts on local other states nearby, sure, then that's a basis for federal regulation. The one general idea I'd offer is that hopefully it's better thought out than California's regulatory.
Be hard not to be.
Fair enough.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. And once again with me are Boston University professors Cutler Cleveland, director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Studies, and Keith Hilton of the Law School, and also Executive Vice President of the Associated Industries of Massachusetts, Robert Ruddick. We've been talking about what price energy can the California crisis happen here. Now, so far, we've outlined who the players are in the energy game, where our energy comes from, how utilities operated when they were regulated, and what's happened since deregulation began. Now we're going to talk about what needs to be done. And what about the future? Let's say it's 2025. What will our electrical power situation be here, be then? Anybody want to take a cut at that?
There are an additional 10,000 or so megawatts that are likely to be built. Maybe you might discount that by several thousand, but a sizable chunk of new generating capacity, upgrades of some of the older plants, which are under some environmental pressures right now. So supply should remain fairly healthy, although there's...
That's for us in the Northeast.
For the Northeast. Then there are issues about... will we be drawing more electricity from, say, Hydro-Quebec, which is one of our main out-of-region suppliers? We are fortunate because there is a new oil and gas field off of Sable Island in Newfoundland, which for the first time has actually put Massachusetts and New England between two supplies of gas, which is a radical
first time
radical notion. That is important.
How does that make you feel, Cutler? You're the environmental man.
Well, I think in terms of the fuel mix, which is one of the biggest drivers of environmental impact, what you'll see nationwide, I don't know about New England in particular, is a steady but noticeable decline in nuclear power generation as no new plants are being built. The older plants are coming offline. Most of that will be taken up by natural gas, I think, particularly here in New England, and a smaller fraction of that by different forms of renewable energy.
Mm. And do you think that, Keith, that the deregulatory environment has gone so far that we're going to see it continue to move in that direction, that that's the way people are thinking now and government as well?
I hope so. I hope we keep moving it. Again, the question is, you know, what kind of deregulation? And California has shown us, you know, some examples of how not to do it. If I were to offer, you know, general recommendations, you don't want to have a system such as California's where you've got this hard cap at the retail level, total freedom for pricing at the wholesale level, which creates the problem of this potential squeeze on the power suppliers. What you'd like to do to avoid this is, you know, one of the big mistakes California did was it didn't allow these power suppliers to enter into long-term contracts with power generators so that they could avoid the volatility of the spot market. So one of the things you certainly want to do is create a deregulatory scheme to the extent we're moving in that direction. You want to create a scheme that allows the companies to avoid the risk of the spot market, allows the companies to avoid the risk of being in a California-type situation in the future. And again, I'd offer that general suggestion of trying to use the market to take into account Cutler's environmental concerns as well.
All right, I'll give somebody an opportunity to summarize what we've been talking about in 15 seconds. What price energy? Can the California power crisis happen here? Bob?
I think we have a better than 75% chance of it not happening here. But there are some dangers. Over-reliance on one particular fuel, over-reliance on one particular system of generation, constraints on generation, that's a problem. Abandonment of efficiency programs, that would be a problem. And passing on in some way insulating the customer from cost impacts tends to create these massive financing costs to California. And so we have to avoid those types of deferrals.
Cutler, you want to take a cut at that one?
Oh, I think, you know, ideally you'd want to have a market where consumers had the greatest choice possible and the market had sufficient information such that the mix of fuels you're choosing from has the lowest possible cost to society, including all these external costs as much as possible. And some of these ridiculous subsidies that different power systems receive should be eliminated as well.
I'll give you a chance at that too, Keith.
The question is, can it happen here? And in theory, yeah, I guess it can happen anywhere if it happened in California. It's my impression, and based on very limited reading, that there's been much more input from policy people and academics and regulatory specialists in the deregulation design here in Massachusetts. And so it seems to me that they've probably thought it through a little bit more carefully. It hasn't been as driven by politics.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. It's been a fascinating hour.
Appreciate you, Ted.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ted.
You've been listening to a Boston University World of Ideas roundtable discussion on where New England stands compared to California with respect to having electrical power now and in the future. Participants included Keith Hilton, professor of law at the Boston University School of Law, the Associated Industries of Massachusetts Executive Vice President, Robert Ruddick, and Dr. Cutler J. Cleveland, Director of the University Center for Energy and Environmental Studies. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Ben Walker and Bob Zalisk. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. I'm Ted O'Brien.